committee to order for Wednesday, February 13th. Welcome, members. I would like to extend my gratitude to Chair Brad Witt and the members of the Workforce Development Committee for joining us here tonight. And some of our members are on both committees who get to, I guess, take double credit or extra credit or something.
Thank you for that.
For being here. But thank you very much, Brad, for coming.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for extending us the invitation. We've, on many occasions, particularly during our informational session during the 2007 session, on many occasions our committee found considerable overlap on the issues that we were dealing with this committee. And so this is the perfect opportunity. And thanks for making it possible. I hope that we can do this many times in the future.
Absolutely. Very much so. Thank you, Chair Witt. I'd also like to remind everyone here to please turn off those cell phones, those Blackberries, those PDAs, because they do interfere with the sound system. And I would also like to acknowledge the fact that this hearing tonight is the result of a trip that the Vice Chair of the Education Committee, Representative Kopp and Representative Wisnett took to find out some great information for our state, and they came back so enthusiastic. They pretty much rattled every possible cage that could be rattled in order to get this together and get this information before our two committees. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my Vice Chairs and let them introduce the presenters tonight.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And some people know I have a dry sense of humor, and no, we did not go to Hawaii. So it is my pleasure to introduce our presenters tonight. When you go to a conference, and I want to kind of set the stage a little bit, and then Representative Wisnett's going to share a few facts, but many people, when you think of a conference, you think of 3,000, 5,000 people, whatever. Well, those types of conferences really aren't the kind of conferences I go to. I like a conference in the setting that we were presented with approximately 30 people from throughout our western states and legislators, representatives, and senators. And we sit around a table and we work hard. It's interesting because our presenters present information, but it's up to us to really do something with it and discuss it and debate it. And so these are a couple of our key facilitators, and I want to introduce Dennis Jones. And Dennis is the president for the National Center of Higher Education Management Systems. And he's been working on things like state and institutional approaches to budgeting and resource allocation, strategic planning, which is one of my favorites, educational needs assessment, faculty workload and productivity, and information for strategic decision making, and the development of educational indicators. And these are perspectives from higher ed. David Longnecker, I probably didn't do that justice, is executive director of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education in Boulder, Colorado, which is where we did go. And it is a regional compact between the Western 15 states, and it was created to assure access and excellence in higher education through collaboration and resource sharing among the higher education systems for the West. It was a phenomenal, very, very informative training, and I will let Representative Wisnett tell us a couple of things why we thought it was important for these two gentlemen to fly from their, probably from both of you, from Colorado, mm-hmm. and to come to Oregon on an almost sunny day.
Mr. Chair, committee members of both, thank you for coming tonight, and I said our audience for our people that are visiting to give the presentation tonight. We have a lot of quality people in education. The numbers are maybe small, but we have the top leaders, and I'm glad to see that. Representative Kopp and I, and we were joined by our administrator, Dana Richardson, and we traveled to Denver for the conference. I think our presenters are from, our David is from Boulder, but and there were 17 states, like a couple of Eastern states, like Georgia was there and North Carolina was there, so it was a representation from across the nation. And it was, as Representative Kopp said, we've all been to conferences where you come back and, okay, check that one off. we both came back, and Dana, and we were energized to help our state because we got an F rating at this conference. But don't feel so bad. Most of the states got F on affordability, and that's what we got the F on. But we weren't so high in the other categories either in this seminar. But they did praise and some of the things that we've done in Oregon that we can all be proud of as legislators to help in fulfilling our workforce development requirements, in that we now have community college credits that will be accepted by our higher education system. We have high school students going to community colleges, and they were real happy and praised and talked about our shared responsibility model for the Opportunity Grant Program. Because what this was all about was identifying that the state of Oregon, the people in the audience know, we don't have an office. We're redoing our capitals. I don't have all the facts in my report from my trip to Denver, but you can correct me, but I think Oregon needs about 60,000 people with degrees, tech schools, community colleges, and higher ed to meet our workforce requirement by 2025, I think. You'll get this in the presentation. So Representative Comp and Dana and I were saying, wow, we got to do something about that. And we want to know where we are. So we came back with Chair Buckley's support. We went out to the university system and said, gave them the report. Good policy best practices. The members of the audience have not gotten a copy of that. We'll want to get you a copy of that because that's what you're going to be presented, some of the facts from that study tonight. But we sent that out to the university system and said, how are we and what can we do as a legislative body to help the state of Oregon develop this workforce? And we do have an answer back. We have not shared that with our presenters tonight. We'll be looking at that, and we'll also, it's been pointed out that we probably should have gone to the community college people, which is the workforce, and asked them to comment on that, too. We went to the university system. But the effort here, we're all dedicated to higher ed and fulfilling our workforce requirements. We realize that the workforce produces the revenue to make this state great. And I'm going to be quiet and let the people travel here to talk. But I hope you'll be as enthused and energized as Representative Comp and our Chair Buckley was after we told him about this trip.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wisner. Gentlemen, welcome officially. And if you'd introduce yourself and start in, we can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'm Dave Longenecker, and I'm with Richie, and Dennis is with NCHEMS. And we were faculty for this NCSL education forum. And tonight what we'd like to do, if it's possible, is do two things with you. The first is to go through a good bit of data about the workforce and education system, the workforce needs and education system that you have in Oregon, and how that compares to others around the country and internationally. And then certainly entertain questions about that at that time, but sort of hold the discussion until you got the whole picture there. We'll come back, and then we're going to focus on about 20 of the slides that Dennis is going to start with, and we're going to sort of probe what those mean for the state of Oregon and how they do come together and fit together and what the challenges and opportunities are for the state. So we're going to start. Dennis is going to go through a good bit of data. Some of this will be sobering. Some of it will be heartening, probably more sobering. And then we'll come back and essentially try to carry on a dialogue with you about what this means for the state of Oregon, at least from the interpretation of two analysts who look at it from an outsider's perspective. Dennis?
Yeah, I'm Dennis Jones. I'm president of the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems. And as David said, my task here is to share some data with you about Oregon, its workforce, and its kind of competitive position in the world, and kind of tee up a conversation that says, as David said, doing some good things. You got some real issues coming down the pike, and so the question is, what kind of policy makes sense in that context? Start with a is a premise that I think we can back up, that says that Oregon is going to need a much more highly educated citizenry than it has now to meet economic challenges globally, to meet future workforce needs. And you take a look at the workforce data and a lot of growth, but two-thirds of the jobs that are going to be available in the next decade are replacements for folks who are retiring. So a huge chunk of the workforce need is a retiree workforce. And then there's just the issues of improving quality of life of the citizens of your state. Oregon, in some ways, is a little bit interesting. It's one of the states in the upper right-hand quadrant up there that is has a relatively high level of high-tech employment. It's got about national average of education attainment, but it's one of the few states that's in the high-tech business where per capita income is below the national average. So the fact that you've got high-tech industries and more than many states hasn't moved the needle on the economy as much as it has in the states. Take a look at everybody to the upper right up there. States like Connecticut, Massachusetts, Colorado, Virginia, Washington, others that also have high-tech employment, they also have much higher per capita incomes than Oregon. Oregon's been stuck below the national average in per capita income for 20 or 30 years. It's been a very long time. In fact, 1975, you were just a titch over the national average, and not since. And as you all know, per capita income varies enormously from one part of the state to another. County to county, there's a factor of two. Up and down I-5, there's some counties that per capita income is very high. For those of you out in the eastern part of the state, you know that there's an awful lot of folks out there with very low incomes. And we'll see the correlation between education and income. You can just lay all of these county maps one on top of the other. High education attainment correlates with benefits of all kinds. And if you don't have it, there are shortages of all kinds. If we take a look at state workforce and the economy, you really want to take a look at the shape of the economy, and then what's the current workforce? What's the in and out migration of a workforce? What's the education system producing? And at the end of the day, pretty short. And one of the things that you will see, I'll foreshadow it a bit, is that Oregon depends very heavily on imported talent, at all levels of talent. This state does not produce anywhere near the level of educated folks that the economy is employing. And when we look at this, and you take a look at the economy is changing, the characteristics of the workforce, there's a current one, there's a lot of retirees, there are lots of folks entering, there is an educational pipeline that you do some things well on and some things not well on, and as I said, a lot of in-migration. It's one of the few states that in-migrates talent at every level and every age category. And it's one of the few for which that's true. And then the question is, and in Oregon, it's not this is part of the workforce development, but there's also a workplace development question. And the issue is one of, is it just training a workforce for a current economy, or is there the question of building an economy that looks different than the old one? And you take a look at what's declining. Wood products and everything else declining as far as the factor in your economy, what's going to take its place, and particularly what high-value jobs are going to take its place, set of questions yet to be answered. Oregon's one of the faster-growing states, or projected to be, in the country. But, all that in-migration adds up to our bodies. But it's a very different population than you've got now. If you take a look at this, almost all of the growth is going to be individuals of color, largely Hispanic, some Asian. The white population, a few in the very young age increase, a few in the 25 to 44. The only place that whites really grow in the next 20 years is in the retiree population. The workforce that's
coming. Can I ask a question then?
You may. Yeah, but one question now. I'd like to let them finish.
Yeah, I mean, very specific question about this chart or something. Is this natural growth, or does that include
It includes a migration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Those kinds of questions.
I'd like to let the presenters finish their presentation. We'll take questions en masse when they're done.
Okay. The workforce 20 years from now will be much less white, much more workers of color, as I said, largely Latino. You're slightly above the national average in the proportion of your population that's in the workforce. You can't fill jobs, a whole lot of them, by bringing other folks into the workforce that aren't already there. And Oregon's a little bit unique in the sense that at all levels of education, more Oregonians are working than is true of the nation as a whole. But still, if you have less than high school education in Oregon, chances are about one out of three that you're not in the workforce at all. It's not that you don't have a well-paying job, it's that you don't have a job. And that's the population that is not only not contributing to society. Those are the ones that are on social services, they're in the correction system, and etc. So they are taking from society. And there's a direct correlation between education attainment and the likelihood that you're working. And then you'll see a little bit later, and the more education you get, the more you make, too. So it really matters that folks get educated. It pays off in all kinds of, not just economic, but social ways. Oregon is pretty much right smack dab in the middle of the pack of the country as far as education attainment from high school on up. And interestingly, the place where it's lowest, 29th, is that working age population with an associate degree. And for an economy that's like yours, the relatively low level of associate degree holders is, to an outsider, surprising. This is where we put it in international context. United States is now 10th in the world as far as the proportion of young folks, 25 to 34 year olds, who have a college education. 3 years ago we were 8th. So we've lost two more spots to France and Spain in the last 3 years. Even more scary than this, the United States and Germany are the only two countries in the developed economies where the 25 to 34 year olds are not better educated than their parents' generation. The 45 to 54 year olds in the United States are better educated than the 25 to 34 year olds. Not by much, but by some. And if you take a look at some of the countries on the left over there, Japan, Korea, Canada, and etc., you see not only that the young folks are better educated than their parents' generation, they are way better educated than their parents' generation. Some of these countries have made just astounding progress over 20 years in the education attainment levels of their adult population. And remember that 25 to 34-year-olds are going to be in the workforce for at least 30 more years. So those countries that are ahead of us now are going to stay ahead of us. The United States is still the best educated workforce in the world, but it's only because us old folks got more educated than the competitors' workforce. It's not because the young people are ahead of the game. And if we put it in state-to-state terms, Oregon is considerably below the national average on this, and it mirrors the United States as a whole. Its young folks are not as well educated as their parents' generation. And if you take a look at Oregon over here on the very right, it's not a recent phenomenon. That downward dip has been happening for 40 years. Every successive decade, the proportion of the population with a college degree is down a little bit. So the 25 to 34 year olds are a little bit less well educated than the 35 to 44s, and etc. It's one of the states over on the right. You don't have New Mexico's problem, but you're still, over the last 20 years, you've lost a percent and a half as far as education attainment of the working age population. Slightly better than the national average, associate degrees in the 25 to 64 year old population. But if you take a look again where those are, associate degree and higher, heavily concentrated in about six or seven counties. And in fact, if you're not dark green on this chart, you're below the state average. So the heavily populated counties are fairly well educated. The rest of the state, much less so. Only 40% of the folks with an associate degree in this state were born in this state. 60% of the associate degree holders migrated from someplace else. That puts you well below the national average on the extent to which you homegrow associate degree holders. National average is 52%, 39% here as far as in-state homegrown talent. If we take a look at education attainment by that different populations, Hispanics, almost half of the Hispanics in the state have not completed high school. And almost 80%, 75% have no more than high school. So what you see is Hispanics are heavily overrepresented on the low end of the education attainment ladder, way underrepresented at the upper end, and that is the population that's growing. So if Oregon is going to cope with workforce shortages, you're going to have to figure out how to educate a population that you haven't been successful at educating historically, or you have to in-migrate talent even more so than you have been. Those are the kind of stark choices that you have. The student pipeline, Oregon gets slightly more than the national average out of high school in 4 years by about 3%. The place where Oregon falls apart, but nobody goes to college once they finished high school relative to the rest of the country. And so at the end of the day, if you start with 100 ninth graders and say, okay, how many go finish high school? If they finish high school, go to college. If they go to college, finish a baccalaureate degree in 6 years or an associate degree in three. If you start with 100 ninth graders, at the end of about 10 years, 15 come out the pipeline with a degree. That means 75, no, or 85, no. Now they may, you know, there are more than that that come out. One of the things that we're seeing is more Oregonians start as part-timers than is common across the country, including right out of high school kids. You know, they're working and going to school more so than is normal across the country. But when you go to school part-time, the chances of your finishing go down. These are data that David's staff put together, and you know the number of high school graduates that you have now is about what you're going to have. You're not going to have any more 20 years from now than you do now, or 15 years, but they're going to be a very different student body. You know, the minority population is going to be much greater and the white population much smaller. This is the point that I was making. If they get out of high school, relatively few go on to college. You know, there's only five states in the country that send fewer high school students directly to college than Oregon. And by the way, all the way through here, just, you know, Oregon's a state where you got to be careful about this. When we say go to college, that includes the community colleges. Okay, I mean, it's not just higher ed, as you know, higher ed in the Oregon University system. All the way through here, this is all post-secondary. So it's not a structural thing. It's just that you don't send them to college, regardless of what kind of college. And if you take a look at it, full-time students, and do it county by county, it only varies by 700%. Coos County down there in the southwest corner, way high. Union County, way low.
You did.
If you take a look at four and part-time, it compresses a little bit. It's only 600% now. But Coos County is still the one that sends the greatest proportion of high school graduates to college. Union County is the one that still sends the fewest. Associate degrees awarded a little better than the national average for high school graduates. If you graduation rates, though, slightly lower than the national average. Baccalaureate degrees for 100 high school graduates, a little better. Right at the national average on graduation rates 6 years after you start if you're a full-time student. And you know, you take a look at national average and you say, well, we're kind of there. The reality is there is no state in the United States that does a really good job here. It's not, you know, national average isn't all that great. The best performing state here isn't all that great, particularly when you take a look at countries like the UK and others that have got about the same proportion of their young folks going to college as we do, and they're graduating 87 or thereabouts percent of their students. So their ability to keep them in college is much higher than is true here. This is the migration point. Every level, both young folks and 30 to 64 year olds, you import in large numbers. You import, however, more or less than high school than you do baccalaureate degree holders. And these are all adults, these aren't kids. So you're not, you know, the importation isn't necessarily resulting in an overall better educated population. You're importing talent and you're importing problems at the same time. Migration rate is one of the highest in the country. For every 1,000 folks with a college degree, you import 75 in a 5-year period. And who do you import? You import the kinds of folks that it takes to drive a new economy, because computer scientists, engineers, all of those folks that are hot, anything that economic development folks would say, those are the ones we want, are the ones that you're underproducing as a state. And in here also are, you will find health professionals, and et cetera. If you take a look at the older population, the big in-migration, interestingly, is in the healthcare world. Practitioners in the healthcare world want to live in Oregon.
That's interesting.
Less than a high school education, you're even, you know, for every 1,000 Oregonians with less than a high school education, in a 5-year period, you imported another 100. So So the in-migration of low in education attainment is higher than those for college. And so where does Oregon find itself? It finds itself in a state that is interestingly a low producer and a high importer of educated talent, more so than many other states. Finally, your economy is changing, as you well know, much less natural resource based, much more service oriented. And when you take a look at the services, that's the big jump on the right hand side over there. You know, manufacturing is going down. It continues to. It's not now where it was 10 years ago. Even with some growth, it's way behind where it was 10 years ago. Services going up. And the big services are tourism, but the biggest one is healthcare. And when you take a look at that baby boomer population retiring, the demand for healthcare workers is going to do nothing but go up and up. And the folks sitting behind me will tell you, those aren't the cheapest folks in the world to educate. You know, the demand for nurses and healthcare workers of all kinds is going to do nothing but go up. And those are among the more expensive folks to educate. And if you're going to have them in all parts of the state, not just Portland, Salem, Eugene, then you have to find a way to educate them closer to home, because you aren't gonna bring folks from Northern California to Eastern Oregon to staff a hospital. It just doesn't happen that way. Oregon's gross state product is amongst the slowest growing in the country. So it's an economy that's not growing nearly as fast as some others. And so it's one of the things where importing people and population growth isn't necessarily translated into economic growth at the same rate. And that's why you see per capita income kind of inching its way down. Fairly high level of employment in high-tech establishments. I pointed that one out already. Take a look at where the growth is, the big growth. And you know, this is from your own Workforce Economic Research Unit here in the state, a report that came out, I think it was December. Take a look 10 years to the future. Population, employment growth, about 14%. Education and health services growth, 28%. The next one is professional and business services, and then after that it kind of drops down to things that are at the average or below the state average as far as growth. Manufacturing, 1%. And we used to think those are the jobs you really wanted, because those were the high-paying jobs. Unfortunately, they were high-paying jobs that didn't require an education. When those jobs go away, the states that had a lot of those jobs are left with the culture that says, we don't have to send our kids to college because we did just fine without it. You know, but the world has changed enough that if you don't have a college education, chances are that you're not going to get a very good hand up the ladder of success. By industries, the big growth is going to be food service, hospitality, etc. The next one is ambulatory health care, and then administrative and support services. And these are the ones that are getting smaller. Wood products, the federal government. The one that's the second one, the top, computer and electronic product manufacturing, is one that's projected to have a fairly substantial downturn. And that's one you've relied on historically as being one of your prime sectors. Relatively slow growth, if you come back to some of these kinds of things, many of those are not jobs that require post-secondary education. And, you know, you're pretty low on the scale of the states of increasing the proportion of jobs that require some education past high school. Doesn't have to be a baccalaureate degree, but it's got to be some education past high school. Per capita income, median earnings. Interestingly, the more education you have, the further behind the national average you are in Oregon. You know, if you have less than high school, you're not too far behind the national average. If you're high school, you're right exactly on the national average. If you have a PhD, you're 10,000, 9,000 below the national average. And at all levels, you're a couple thousand below the national average. So part of the problem that Oregon's got is got a lot of jobs, a lot of people are working, a lot of people are probably working two jobs. They're just not working high-value jobs in lots of instances. And finally, there's some, lots of things you do well. The thing at the lower left-hand corner over there, one above, and then back to that question, is it workforce development or is it workplace development? This argues that a good bit of this is workplace development. You generate about as few jobs from startup companies as any state in the United States. So there's not the kind of orientation toward entrepreneurship and startups and cranking up new things here, at least at the same level as it is true in other parts of the country. Yeah. So quick tour de force through some data about Oregon. I'm going to turn it over to David and let him...
What we're going to try to do here now is to go back to some of these data and have a discussion with you folks about what this logically means for Oregon, how we interpret this. Dennis has provided the facts, and we'll talk about each of those in a little bit. And where we want to talk is about some of the ahas that we see in this set of figures that Dennis showed you that compares Oregon to the United States and to the highest performing countries in the world in terms of the share of the adult population that is educated. There are, I think, a couple of very significant findings here, particularly for Oregon, and Dennis touched on those. One is that the U.S. loss is not, overall the U.S. loss is really in position, isn't so much because it's declined, but because the others have made such substantial progress. If you look, the U.S. indeed has declined. It's one of the only two countries in the Western world, in the developed world that has. But it's pretty close to where it was before, and if you look across that second to the last, you see that it's not... Yeah, I mean, it's sort of right there in that same area. But those other countries have all been moving up at huge rates. And to those who say that, you know, this is really not something, a needle you can move, that basically you are where you are and where you will be, there's an awful lot of evidence here that that's not true. I mean, people talk about Ireland today and what has happened in Ireland in one generation. And you can see it. Ireland moved from near the bottom of these countries to near the top. And the same is true of France and Spain, which just passed us. And if one looks at Korea has moved from almost no one having a college education to almost everyone having a college education. Well, not everyone, over half. And they have a national agenda to have 100% of their population educated at the collegiate level. And they're a society that when they say they're going to do that, there's a pretty good chance, except for their professional golfers, that will be the case. From our perspective, this is, I think, a huge challenge for us. If you look at those countries that are behind us, at current glide paths, the United States will not be 10th. Within another 5 to 10 years, we'll be 15th or 16th. In fact, we won't really have an immigration problem with Mexico in one generation, except for that our population will probably be trying to go to Mexico because they will surpass many of our western states within one generation, given the current glide path in terms of the share of the population with college education. What is also notable here is that while the United States has been sort of in the same place, that's not true of Oregon. Oregon has been in continuous decline, with the most significant decline actually occurring between that 45 to 54-year-old and 55 to 64-year-old. It's not essentially the fault of recent immigrants that your education level has declined. So that's sort of where you are in your global circumstances. How does that feel? How do you folks read? What are your reactions to this and some of that? We'll get into some other things along the line, but I want to get some sense of this.
Maybe it's going to happen.
Chair Buckley, I'd just like to thank Dana and Patrick for clearing all sharp instruments before we came in and heard this. That's my feeling.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments at this point?
The other thing that I would note off this chart, the very right-hand number, that's the population that's about to retire, and that's the best educated part of your population.
Representative Witt.
I'd be interested, Mr. Chairman, thank you, in asking our panelists here if they've bored into the data and been able to determine why it is that we have a declining college-educated population. Is it related to our higher ed infrastructure? What basis do you attribute this decline to?
Well, actually, we have not seen substantial declines in the share of young people going to college. But America has one of the leakiest collegiate systems in the world. And it's not, I don't think, the fault of American higher education. This is nothing new. This has always been the way of American higher education. We're the most egalitarian in open access to our system and the most casual about the experience in some respects. A much smaller share of American students who go to college graduate from college than is true in most of the countries. Now, some of the data on this is not as good as this data because we also have a different pattern of college attendance than most of the rest of the country. In fact, most of the students at Portland State, I'll bet you, started their education at some other institution. And that's very different than other countries. In other countries, students generally graduate from the institution they begin in. And so when we measure graduation rates based on the share of students who started at college, we're not really picking up the full numbers. But when you put all of those numbers in, and in fact you've done that extremely well in your community colleges, I don't know if you've done it in four-year colleges with looking at the National Clearinghouse data, but it doesn't change the world very much. Americans don't complete their education. And we just don't do it at the same level. So what happened, I think, is these other countries which had very meritocratic or elitist systems where the ethic was if you went to college, you completed it, but you probably wouldn't go to college. When they changed their ethic and opened it up so that a much larger share of the population goes to college, they still had that ethic that if you went, you complete it. And we just haven't haven't been able to adjust. I think that's part of it. I would also say that we've just lived through the wealthiest period of time in the nation. And to some extent, education, this sort of comes with wealth. One can look at great civilizations and see that when you're not hungry, you don't work as well. And I think that's something, some of what's going on. I don't think it's a failing infrastructure in higher education. I think it's more the ethics, sort of the culture of American participation in post-secondary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would also be interested in knowing the level of affordability of higher education in the United States vis-a-vis those countries that have a higher percentage of college-educated population.
Well, I'll give you some of those countries. The United States invests more in post-secondary when you put together the public and the private investment. The United States puts more into post-secondary education as a share of GDP than any country in the world. We put about 2.5% of GDP into post-secondary education. The other highest country, I believe, is now I believe it's now Korea, I'm not quite sure of that, at around 1.5%. And we put as much in public funds as most of those leading countries. We put about 1.2%. The rest comes through tuition. Many of those countries do not have any tuition whatsoever. Others do and have, and most are moving toward a tuition structure because it's very difficult to sustain a system that was elitist for a few. When you open it up to a lot, they're finding they can't afford it, so they're having to charge consumer price as well. What's interesting about this, Korea is entirely a private pay system. And they don't have hardly any public investment. The people pay exceptionally high prices, and they move. So cost doesn't seem to be the driving feature, although I would say, I think if you look at the differences in participation patterns in Oregon, I believe that cost could have been a factor in the reasons your students go part-time rather than full-time, the reasons they don't complete it the same, the reasons they don't go on. You had a fairly high cost structure in your public system. The introduction of the shared responsibility plan, I think, will address that to a great extent. Time will tell whether it's successful or not, but it should help to address that concern.
Ms. Angelizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the first questions that came to mind was, is being in the legislature considered participating in the workforce? That was one of the first things I wanted to know. But
yes, necessarily productive work.
He's gotten that question before.
So obviously, there are sort of a multiplicity of factors that affect these decision to go to college and completing education. And it was interesting that we're seeing all this data comparing countries and states when there are just so many factors that affect this. That's, I'm not saying that it's not valid, but there was no caveat. So I'd be interested to hear you talk about that. But when you talk about the Latino population, so obviously there are some states that have a much larger Latino population, Texas, Florida, California. And I don't know that Oregon, percentage-wise, compares at all to those states, but I wonder if there are, I'd be interested to hear, maybe it's not now, but how does Oregon compare with other states that maybe have a similar percentage of Latinos in the population in terms of those Latinos attending some post-secondary education?
It's not appreciably different. The United States in general has not been very successful in serving students of color, period, but particularly African American and Latino students. And Latino students are much less likely to complete their elementary and secondary education. If they do, they're much less likely to go to college. If they go to college, they're much less likely to complete. So that's not unique to Oregon, but it is, and that is the fastest growing population in most of the western states. And what is unique to Oregon is the extent to which your growth is essentially driven entirely by that population. Your growth in the potential workforce.
So are you saying that states such as California or Florida or Texas, which for a longer period of time has had a greater percentage of Latinos, your data shows those states are not doing demonstrably better? In other words, they haven't adapted better than, say,
No. America has not adapted well. The one state that has done, I think, a reasonably good job but still has sorry statistics is New Mexico. We could move to a second. Well, I'm sorry.
Thanks, Chair Buckley. The psychological drivers, if you will, culturally speaking, like Korea, is it just understood that Korean 18-year-olds will continue their education? I think college here in the U.S., a lot of it's dealt with and thought of experientially. It's the college experience. Good friend of mine grew up in Greece, and he was relating to me that their culture, certain things were just understood, and it wasn't questioned. In some of these other countries that have a higher graduating population from college, Are there understood particulars?
It may be, but I think that a couple of countries up here in particular are instructive, and the two that I would point to are Korea and Ireland. And both of them have shown enormous growth in the education attainment levels of their populations. And if you go back two decades, one of the things you will see, as a matter of national policy, they established very high goals for what they were trying to accomplish as far as education attainment of their population. And they put in place a whole series of policies that reinforced that. I mean, this was as much national policy as it was family expectation, etc. I mean, it's one of, I think one can make a very strong case that policy matters on this one. By far, I think the two best examples are Ireland and Korea out of these. And we could probably, one of our staff members has done studies in both of those countries. They're just an infrastructure and a policy framework that says that we're gonna create a mechanism that says we value this, we support this, and it is as much social policy as it is economic and education policy. Okay, I mean, there's a whole set of stuff that goes around.
Let's burrow down a little bit, if we could, into Oregon and take a look, and we'll go to that demographic chart that Dennis put up that shows where your growth is. And I think there are a couple of ahas in here. One of these that I think is important to look at is that growth of the 65 and older. That blue line is a constrained line or something. That's not really, that line, in fact, to get where it was supposed to be would have gone off the page. That's what the 460,000 is intended to reflect to you. I think there are a couple of important ahas for you in this. Well, one is that if you look at this, essentially the only two major growth areas of your population, you're one of the fastest growing states, that's true, but most of that growth is in the two populations that don't pay much in the way of income tax, which is what you folks rely on. It's the elderly and the young. There's not a whole lot of people in there in that, a whole lot of growth in those 18 to 24 to 64, irregardless of what race or ethnicity there are. This is a state that's going to have a lot of growth between now and 2025 in young people who will demand a lot from you in educational services, both K-12 and post-secondary, and older folks who will demand a great deal from you in medical services and other areas, and will not be contributing in the same way in terms of revenue streams as has been the case in the past. Now, the rest of the story is really the Hispanic population and the growth of that in each of the areas and how significant a share of your overall growth in the state will come in that new and emerging growth population.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Burkhart, thank you. I don't understand the scale. If I read the scale literally, there'll be 460 million 65 and older white people in the United States by 2025, and I don't believe that.
This is it's 465,000.
All right, so the in thousands is wrong. Is that right? They're in the label. You're actually meaning units.
In units. That in thousands should go away. I'm sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Now it used to make sense. The other comment I had it was based on your earlier comment. The other numbers there are all 50,000 or less, no matter what the number is.
Yeah.
That number is nine times that much.
Yeah.
Is that, we're not getting that just from Oregon. That's in migration, isn't it? Where's that coming from? That gigantic number.
Well, this is 15 years out, and you do have a very large retiring population. that, and as Dennis pointed out, it's also your best educated population.
Well, but the decline in the 45 to 64 year old group is only 40,000 people.
That's right.
If we're moving 15 years out, presumably many of the people in that age group are moving into the next one. So somehow or another, we've got another 420,000 people in that blue bar in the 65 and older group.
Yeah, but and the other piece of it is, like in Oregon, I'm presuming, and I don't, you know, if we'd cut this in a different way, those folks that are 65 and older are living a lot longer than they used to.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's more 85-year-olds than ever. That 65 and older has got a lot of folks that are...
But that wouldn't show up on here, because this is just growth. They're already there.
This is change.
Right.
They're growing to that from the middle-aged population.
Right.
There's a very significant reduction in the age-specific mortality rates for people over 65.
Yeah, this just takes a look at today's population or 06's population. Takes a look at the 2025 population and say, what's the difference?
My point is that this 15-year period, we're going to see a 10 times larger growth in the 65 and older population than you get decline in the 45 to 64 population.
California.
It's mostly got to be in migration, doesn't it?
A lot of it is.
Well, I mean, you...
If those numbers are real.
A lot of folks live in Bend.
And we'll have the progression from the at each level.
Sure. I understand that. Thank you.
Now, so that's sort of who you are and are going to be as a population. So in that environment, and given the workforce needs you need, how well are you educating your population for that future workforce? As this one shows, you're really about average in college attainment overall, that we're showing. You have a fairly high share of your population with some college, but not a college degree.
There's only three generations.
And that is a potential avenue for you as you move along, because these are people that for one reason or another didn't complete their degree. Now, there's an argument that people make about whether it's important to have a college degree, but all of the evidence is that the return on investment of that credential, that it is presumed to have some strength, obviously, by employers, because the return on investment is very substantial for people who, the difference between those people who have some education and those who have a college degree.
Vice Chair, was it?
David, go back to that slide, please.
Yes.
I think that's what the number I was talking about when we're talking here about we need more college degree holding people, 2 years and 4-year degree. And that... this people that dropped out, I've talked to several people. I think that's one of the things I came back from Denver saying, that we need to look some way, if those people have dropped out of the system, the easiest way to get our numbers up quickly are to go after those people who have had some college, some community college, get them back, get their 2-year degree or get their 4-year. That's a strategy for Oregon that we need to look at and come up with policy that will help us achieve that goal. Would you agree?
I would agree. I think it's sort of the low-hanging apples. That won't solve your problem, as we'll get to in a minute. But it is an area where you can get some potential gains fairly quickly. And you also have the other dilemma that, as our future day will show, that your students don't go to college right away. And in fact, what your students do, because of the way in which they pursue higher education, they increase what we call the risk factors of never completing. If you look at the work that's been done by a fellow at the National Center for Education Statistics, guy Cliff Edelman, he's looked at all of these databases really closely, and he's identified those factors that lead to people not completing their education. Not going on to college directly out of high school is one. Going part-time is another. I mean, you sort of hit those pieces one after the other. Net price is another, and you've been fairly high in net price.
Well, could I inquire on that subject? Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't know, do we, that most of those items, except price, is causative, do we?
Well, aren't those simply descriptors of potentially at least descriptors of something else that's going on?
Right.
Well, we know that what we know is there's a correlation. We don't know for sure.
We don't know what the reason for the correlation is. We don't know that it's causative.
Yeah, that's true. But the data that this fellow Cliff Edelman has put together really do suggest that those are pretty strong those become fairly strong barriers to completing the education. That if students don't take a certain number of hours, that they then have, it appears that they have so far, I mean, there could be other factors, and there certainly are other factors that account for that. But when you control for all of those factors, those are the ones in the regression equations, those are the ones that come out as the most significant predictors of a student not completing their education.
Okay, so they're co-correlates is what they are.
Yeah.
All right, could I inquire a little more? Thank you. That doesn't necessarily imply solutions, though, does it? I mean, let me give you an example of what I'm thinking. If the reason why people don't start college right away is because of family attitude, one reason might be family attitudes.
Yeah.
College isn't very important, don't worry about it. Another might be finances. We don't have any money, you're going to have to go earn some.
Yeah.
There may be a variety of other reasons. School was hard in high school, college is likely to be even worse. I mean, I'm making these things up, you understand, but those might be real causes, and what you're giving us are descriptors, I think. I'm not criticizing the numbers, I'm simply trying to understand what they might mean.
No, you're absolutely right.
But if you take those examples and say, okay, what does policy look like? One of the sets of policies that you come back to is remove the barriers to getting a good step of education right out of high school.
Okay, so understanding why it is that people don't go on to college directly out of high school would then give you hints as to what you ought to do to change those whys.
Yes, and I think this is why, and every state needs to really, I mean, there is no template we can give you for Oregon that would fit perfectly because that's what works in states. Every state has a different culture that they're working with, a different set of circumstances. But what I think is important is to understand the consequences of not changing the current behavior patterns for the states. You'll need to figure out how to do that, but what we're trying to help you appreciate is the consequences of not of all else being equal for the future of the state.
Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very sensitive to the kinds of barriers that Representative Barnhart was describing. I'm equally interested in those items that would incent someone to first enter and then complete their college education. And you seemed to indicate earlier that in those countries that have a high percentage of college graduates, that national policy played a very important role. And the question that I would ask in that regard is, in those countries, education to what end? What role does national policy play in incentivizing me or any other person to want to complete my education? What is it on the back end when I come out of that pipeline, that college pipeline? What is it that incents me to want to continue? And I know you mentioned Ireland earlier. 15 years ago, roughly, we were looking at a low-wage, low-skill country and chose to not even to compete. It was a third-world country, in essence. Moved to high-skill, high-wage base. Is it that kind of incentive that was enough to motivate people to want to complete their college educations, that the reward on the end of that pipeline is I have a very high opportunity to earn a very good living?
I think that for post-secondary education, the motivation for an individual is almost completely economic. I mean, you take a look and you ask students why did they go to college. It is 90% now, say, to get a better job. 40 years ago, that was not much less the case. But, you know, the people at UCLA who do that study every year, that number now is hovering around 90% says the reason I go is to get a better job. If that's the case, then the relationship between the world of work and the world of education takes on huge meaning. And so in some states,
you know, one of the problems is that there is no economy to go into. I mean, that's Mexico's problem, for example. I mean, one of the real problems that New Mexico has is that if you get an education, the only way you can use that education is leave the state, because there's not a job there for you. That's not Oregon's problem. You know, what strikes me as so interesting in Oregon, it is at the same time an importer. So it's not like there aren't jobs here. But the local folks are not the ones taking advantage of it. And I just, you know, and this may be a generation of cultural change. I mean, and we see it in states that were heavily dependent on the auto industry. For you it was a different industry, but it had some of the same characteristics. You can make a pretty good living without an education, and those jobs go away, but the culture around them didn't. If you go to Michigan, you go to Ohio, some of those states, one of the real tough times the state's having is to persuade folks and say, you know, those jobs aren't coming back. That you can hang on forever, but the jobs that you're going to get are going to require an education, and that goes down hard with dad and granddad, who used to go to the plant and did very nicely, thank you. And there's some of that, I think, in Oregon.
The data is pretty clear. We'll have some data in a minute to talk specifically about, I think, the uniqueness of Oregon in this, because I think this is part of your dilemma and part of your solution.
Chair, what's the follow-up, and what's the answer after that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But gentlemen, if you could help me, if you could provide some insight into the countries that are relative success stories, then I would have a better feel, a better grasp, insights into the public policy implications for our state.
Well, I think you can see it in Ireland. What Ireland did is create a workplace that could employ the workforce. In fact, truth be told, and you can see this throughout a number of the European countries, many of their companies are led by Irish folks who used to leave the country because there weren't any good jobs. Now they create the workplace. Korea, I think, has taken a slightly different tack. They have simply upped their credentials. So you can't get a job now in Korea without these degrees, so you're going to have to get a degree in order to get the job. I'm not sure that's the right way to deal with things, but it is sort of the way in which they've done it. But you've got a couple of different strategies there. In England, what they're trying to do, they're trying to do it in terms of workplace again. They're trying to make sure that they have jobs for these people. In the United States, because we have such substantial migration, there's a question as to whether that's imperative. You guys have a pretty strong economy built on folks coming from South Dakota where there weren't any jobs, and North Dakota and others. So when you've got mobility, you can actually have that sort of perverse consequence of buying your talent from someplace else. But we'll come to that, because that's not going to last. And it's really important.
Yeah, if I may, I was sitting here thinking for quite a while now about the fact that there's something that happens with people, and it can explain two of the phenomena we see, and that is that the older folks in Oregon are more educated than the younger folks, and the other phenomenon being that there are countries who were very low in education, now very high, and that is newcomers to a religion are much more radical. And I believe that explains a whole lot of what's going on. Is when you start very low, when you're a newcomer to a religion, you're extremely radical, and that's, it can explain a lot. I was the first one, as many in my generation are, the first one in my family to go to college. Mm-hmm. And that was true of many in my generation, and therefore we are better educated because it was the thing, you know, we had to do it. We were the first ones with the opportunity, therefore we were going to do it. So that explains, I believe, a couple of those phenomena. I don't know that that tells us what to do about it. But I think it might get us closer.
Well, I want to show you two slides, which I think you're right. I think that's part of it, is that there's a new ethic in Ireland, which is to go to school, and you're supposed to do that.
Right.
And there was actually in the United States in the 60s. We had Sputnik in 1957.
Right.
If we were a good American, we were going to go on to get an education so we could protect America. And there was that kind of zealous energy. Then we became educated. It's not quite as big a deal as it was. I think there's something to that. But I think there's something about Oregon that is fairly unique in this and the next slide. In this one, you will see that by and large, education doesn't pay off as much. It certainly pays off in Oregon as it does in every state. But it doesn't pay off as much in Oregon as it does elsewhere. Your folks with less than a high school do less well than those with a high school and whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's about a 10% premium that sort of or loss, not the opposite of a premium, what would that be? Deficit for those who have a college degree, whatever level it is. And I think that's partly because also your folks are much more likely. Now you'll see here, this Dennis had this up in a slightly different way. People with less than a high school are less likely to have a job, period. High school students are less likely to have a job than those with some college. But these numbers aren't nearly as high as they are in other states.
Which number?
If you have less than a high school education, many of the states with which I work, they're as likely to not have a job as to have a job.
It's likely to be 50% is rather than 30%.
The yellow bar is longer.
Yes. And so you have, folks can still get a job in Oregon. May not be a good job, but they can get a job. Even without a high school education, two-thirds of them can get a job. Even with a high school education, three-quarters of them can get a job. So it's not quite as dramatic, the penalty for not getting your education in Oregon. Now, I don't know what they're doing. I can guess what they used to do. I don't know what they're doing today, but they've got jobs, and that's something. And they earn not as much, but they earn some. And if they got a college education, they earn more, but not that much more. And so I think there is one of the dilemmas you've got is what this all leads to is a lower skill, lower wage economy than you used to have, obviously, and one that's leading toward that. This is not a scenario. This is one of those areas where I think individual behavior doesn't add up to the benefit of the collective need.
What do you think, Robin?
Two things on this chart. One, when you have the not in civilian workforce, that really frustrates me when we talk about 4% and 5% unemployment, and you're saying this is one of the better states, and that looks like unemployed people, but they're certainly not in the unemployment.
Not all people not in the workforce are unemployed.
Okay.
Many of those are people who have left the workforce by choice for one reason or another, to raise a family or whatever, and also the way we define unemployment is essentially by saying that if they didn't find a job in a reasonable amount of time, then they must not have wanted to.
Okay.
And so
I just want to make sure that was
unemployed. But by and large, there are a lot of people not in the workforce by choice, and so this includes them. But it's hard to believe that those people who don't have any education really don't want to be in the workforce. Well, maybe then I'm wrong.
The other one that I find interesting in that previous chart, you know, we've always said there was a premium for living in Oregon because we have a lifestyle that's so much better. So you can look at that premium. It's about 10%.
Well, there may be another premium. You show us the difference in what we earn. How does our cost of living compare?
I don't know, Dennis. You do some work in that area. I know.
Yeah,
we get that question a lot, and we have yet to find a state where the cost of living differential overcomes this problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, that it doesn't compensate for the lack of. So if there's a 10% premium here, I suspect that statewide cost of living is 5%.
Okay.
I mean, even in Hawaii, where it's monstrous, it doesn't go anywhere close.
I did want to make a comment about how nice it was to have them set Coos County out there like they did. And to acknowledge that that was really all about Aspire. So if you're thinking about whether Aspire should be funded, you should recognize that Coos County is disproportionately Aspired.
Thank you, Representative.
Aspired.
Please continue.
I passed over this. I wanted to come back just for the very brief thing to point out what Dennis had pointed out, where you're pretty average on almost everything except for the share that go to college. And then after that, the share of those who go to college to succeed, you're about average on, and those who and whatever. But the trouble is, when you drop off that much, then that is the one that really sort of hammers to the lower level over time. But let's talk a little bit about the migration patterns in the state. You migrate in an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that at the collegiate and the bachelor's and associate degree level. About half of your immigration comes in those areas, and that's what accounts for your being at the national average in college attainment. It's really the immigration of these folks. That's much larger share than your, if you will, indigenous population's education level. So you're really becoming educated through immigration. But that's not all. I mean, you are importing a huge number of people who have much less education than that, as well, as Dennis pointed out.
So can I make a point on this one, then? And one of the realities is that you are importing a lot of folks from the Midwest and et cetera. And they are willing to move because there's not a job there. However, if you start taking a look at the replacement issue for them, the retirees is going to be the same. That big jump is going to happen in Ohio as well. These young folks that have been coming here are going to start finding opportunity to stay home and get a job. And grandma and grandpa are going to like that a lot better if their grandkids can grow up next door than if they got to go halfway across the country. So you've benefited in many ways from a push out from an economy in other parts of the country. That push out is not going to be as strong in 10 years from now as it is now. So your ability to import at the same rate is not going to be quite as easy as it has been. And that number is going to be less available.
Representative Greenland.
This is the point that I want to get to, and the whole question of importing. Yes, you assert that, but the studies I've seen of the movement of young people, they're not necessarily moving for jobs. They're moving to places like Portland and Austin and Colorado Springs, and places that there is the argument that for a 26-year-old single person, Dayton, Ohio is not Portland, Oregon. And even if they had a job in Dayton, Ohio, they still might want to come to Portland or to Colorado Springs or to places that have a different culture level. So, I mean, could you share some of the data you have on this push-out? And
well, there's one very classic one that's just become available. California, since, I don't know, the beginning of time, since 1849 or whenever the gold rush began, has been a net importer of high talent, of high-skill, high-wage talent. It has been sort of the mecca. It's been the one that has been the greatest draw. This last year, California, for the first time in history, lost more people with a college education than it gained. It's been a mecca. The point that Dennis has made, it may be that those students will want to come here, but they had to come here. We have thought it was because
They loved Seattle and Portland and Denver and Phoenix.
Well, I've seen by the economists around here talking particularly about that immigration of the 18 to 30.
Yeah. But that's where the jobs were. I mean, we believe because of Mount Hood. But there's some truth to that and the oceans. But in fact, the other factor has been there have been jobs here. There were no jobs for students who graduated from Ohio State University in Ohio. There were no jobs for students who graduated from South Dakota State University in South Dakota. The South Dakota School of Mines and Technology sends over 80% of its graduates to Washington and Colorado. And that's because there were no jobs in that state for those people with those technical degrees. It could be that the draw is cultural as well, but the fact remains that it was more than cultural. It was also just getting a good job in a nice place, but getting a good job. They'll be able to get a good job in Columbus. And that's a nice city.
Tell me if you haven't been to Columbus.
Strike that from the record, please. Hey, Jim, just a kind of time check here. We have about 25 minutes left, so now we're hoping to get to your list of recommendations to solve this.
Well, also, I want to mention a couple of things. Here's something that's really important, and it's important to you. If you look at your economy and where those jobs are and are going to be, the growth is almost entirely, and the huge numbers are in service and financial and service industries. That's where your jobs are going to be. They're not going to be in agriculture. There'll be still some jobs in manufacturing, but not nearly as many as there were. This is, I think, a real dilemma for the West, in that we have cultures that are built around our agricultural and natural extraction industries, and we spend an awful lot of time thinking about those and planning for those, and not a lot of time thinking about and planning for the new economy jobs for the future, and what those are and how we will develop. Dennis mentioned this state does not do a very good job on the side of small business development and entrepreneurship and new jobs for new industries compared to other places. That's going to be critically important to you. If one looks at where you do extremely well, you do really well on migration. We'll talk about that. You do very poorly on college going out of high school and the difference in earnings for people between an associate degree and a high school degree. You're probably substantially underinvested at that mid-level in higher education too, in the associate degree component. You're importing an awful lot of your talent in that group, and why the discrepancy is actually a little less there between the incomes elsewhere and that level versus baccalaureate is. So.
What was going to happen?
Thank you, Chair. Can I quickly ask what the lag time is between policy making and when did Oregon make decisions and set policy to put us in the financial and service sector? And how long does it take to set policy and then see a change?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not sure you ever did make policy to do that.
Okay.
I mean, that's, and in fact, you know, most of these things, it's policy by accretion rather than policy by intention. And you know, one of the things, you know, and like Korea, like Ireland, there are some states, Minnesota being one, and some others that have taken a look at data like this, put it on a table and said, you know, we need, you know, in Minnesota's case, explicitly, they said, we need to think of ourselves as a small country that has to compete with the best in the world. What does it do to do that? And then what is our strategy going to be to get from here to there? You know, and so as a state, they are moving down the same kind of policy path as Ireland.
Which is
which is the,
well, and what they're doing is saying, and we need to focus on a couple of things.
Okay. We need to focus on, you know, we have a minority population, and we have to work very explicitly on how we're going to address the undereducation and the education needs of that population. They have, you know, they take a look at their research infrastructure, and they say, we're really good at the medical and health sciences. We don't have a second leg of that stool. What, if anything, are we going to invest in as another component of our research capacity in this state, such that we are not just a one-trick pony as far as competitiveness in that?
Okay, and so there are explicit conversations going on about, will it be information technology, and if so, how are we going to do that? You know, I mean, it's those kinds of things where the answers aren't there, but the debate is now on the, you know, the issues are now on the table in a very explicit way.
I know that some in the state of Oregon have having discussions with people in Ireland about how they put their strategies together, and I think I'd encourage that kind of discussion, because there's a set of policymakers that intentionally did some things. They're about the same size as you are. They compete in an environment, the European community, not unlike the one you compete most directly in, the U.S. Community, and I think there are value. There is value in having discussions with people who have shared similar circumstances and done something with it. Let me just give you an idea, though, of what the size of the challenge is for you. If you were to get to the best in the world today, which is 55% with a college degree, and this isn't 40-40-20, which you guys have been talking about as a goal. This is much less ambitious than that. This is just to get to where the best in the world are today. You'd have to produce about 1.2 million graduates between now and 2025. Now that sounds like an awful lot, but in fact, it is a lot. But your current production function will produce about half of that, about 464,000 folks, and you'll pick up, all else being equal, nearly another 200,000 through immigration. Now, we've raised the question about whether you'll be able to do that, but all else being equal, you'd pick that up. And that would leave you about a quarter of a million short of where you needed to be in terms of degrees. And that would require, for you to get to that point, a 66% increase in your productivity in your higher education system from where you are today. And so your real choice is whether you want to move toward a low-skilled, low-wage economy, which is where you're sort of headed today without change, whether you want to finance that adequate higher education system, or whether you want to get to the workforce from some other level by being more aggressive in recruiting folks and not educating people or something like that. At the current cost structure, it would cost an additional $411 million above in current dollars for you to get to that point over the next 15 years.
Mr. Bishop-Barnard,
thank you. At the current cost structure, what we're spending currently in Oregon.
Yes, you'd need to put in an additional $411 million on top of the 722.
Okay. So let me follow up. If I believe that the current cost structure is not sustainable, and that is what I believe, then it's more than that, isn't it? What I mean is that we can't keep up what we're doing now with the current cost structure.
Yes. If your answer is correct.
Thank you.
If you do business in the same way. If you decide to shift that cost from the state to the students, it would require a net increase in tuition of 30% at the universities and about
80% at the community colleges. And that's, in essence, what you guys have done over the last few years.
Yeah, right. The chancellor's not in his head. He agrees with
you. So it's not, whether these are intentional policy decisions or unintentional, these are the way things sort of work out. And in essence, if you look at this, if you pursue exactly where you are today, the strategies, you'll actually move down in the share of your population because you've got fewer students going on to college and all of that. Now, with immigration, you'd cover a good portion of that, but you're still left with a substantial gap there that needs to be filled. If you got to best in the world practice in high school graduation, best in the nation practice, in high school graduation, in going to college, in getting through college, if you got the best in the nation on all of those, you could add a substantial number of additional students, but you would still be short about 60,000 students, the number that you brought up. If you did everything as good as anybody else, you'd still be short about 60,000 students to fill the logical gap that you have, which means, of course, that you then have to go to adult students and others, some of those low-hanging apples, to bring them in to sort of fill that piece out. It is a huge challenge for you. To some extent, I think that suggests you've got to also become more productive and efficient in the system overall than you are today. Some of that you would achieve through growth. But if your system, if you do it the same way you are today, it'll cost the 411. And Representative Barnhart, your point is you don't believe that's adequately funded today, so that it's
correct. Sure. I don't believe that our current system is sustainable with the inputs we put into it. That's exactly what I believe.
Yes. Now, there are states that have somewhat higher levels of degree productivity than you have. If you were able to achieve those levels of degree productivity, then you would achieve some substantial savings in the system. That is, if the students who started finished, you would get a larger number of degrees, and you would get the value of the investment you put into one or two or three years of those people before they agree. And that would bring that cost down to about $311 million.
Vice Chair Wisner.
Talk about your idea that you pay people for completion not to go to college.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what England does. England pays on enrollments very much as we do, but they pay on completed enrollments rather than on attempted enrollments. Everybody completes their enrollments in England because the institutions don't get paid if they don't.
Hear that, Chancellor?
And so it really has a different set of incentives.
By productivity, do you mean the amount of students per dollar invested? Do you mean productivity in the classical economic sense? Or?
The number, here I'm using as the numerator degrees, so it's the number of degrees. It's the dollars invested per degree.
So our productivity, you're saying, is relatively low?
Yes, because you have relatively low throughput.
Yeah.
Not relatively low. You're about average for throughput. What I was saying is if you did as well as the best in the country at throughput on degree product.
Dollars per being. I'm trying to understand what you're saying. I understand if we push people more through, then we would have more graduates. Okay.
Yeah.
But you said in terms of productivity, and productivity is usually measured in some other context, and I'm wondering if you're using productivity in the sense of dollars per student or dollars per graduate.
Yeah.
Yes. Dollars per graduate, not dollars per student. Yeah. In fact, I think that's one of the flaws we've had in our system. And Dennis would probably agree with me on this, is that we've tended to be focused on enrollments and not on outcome, on inputs and not outcomes. You heard this story a million times. And if you're going to pay on the basis of inputs, you'll get a lot of input. If you pay on the basis of outcomes, you'll get a lot of outcomes.
See point.
I mean, one of the things, and I don't know what the number is here, but we took a look at another state that funds on the basis of enrollments and et cetera. And they kind of counted at the third week of the semester and said that's what we pay on.
then they found that in the community colleges, about one third of the course enrollments never got completed. So, you know, after the census date, a third of the course enrollments disappeared. The institution was collecting for that third, but there was no outcome for it. At the four-year institution, the number was about 25%. And so, you know, there's an awful lot of, you know, because the institutions have to staff, have to fund and address.
Now, there's some squeamish people behind us right now. My old friends.
These are just
former friends. but we have tended to reinforce. I've argued that we get what we pay for in higher education. We don't get what we want. That's because we're not paying for what we want. People, as we pay for enrollments, and you have to be very careful as you construct your policies that you don't create some perverse sort of un-American policies. You don't want institutions to turn down at-risk students. In fact, what Arizona is doing to address that, what New Mexico has done, is they're paying a premium for those at-risk students because they're pretty sure that the regular students are going to get through. I mean, your kids and mine are pretty much going to get through college. It's the at-risk folks that are, I mean, that's why we call them at-risk. And so what they're doing in New Mexico is they're paying a premium for those for serving Pell Grant recipients who transfer, and then those who get degrees, they're sort of a bonus for those. It looks like Arizona will be doing the same thing. And incidentally, Ireland does that as well. Ireland did studies. They found out that those students were less likely to succeed. They weren't sure whether it was culture or whether it was other factors. But what they said is they knew that those students came with educational disadvantages that other students didn't have. They looked at what it cost to provide services to abate those educational disadvantages. It was one third. They pay a third more for students who come from disadvantaged the male codes. Not the best measure. We've got a much better one in the United States. The Pell Grant recipient would be a good way to do that.
Maybe Santa Lucia.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Representative Wilson a question, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I saw that you think that's a good policy. So how does that square with your philosophy of personal responsibility? In other words, a student, usually an adult, makes a decision, I'm going to attend a college. And then that student, for we don't know what reason, then stops going. You want to punish the institution. What about the personal responsibility of the student?
It's not an institution, it's the individual. You need to read the paper that these gentlemen put out. This has been done in other states. I'm not proposing something hasn't been done, Larry. It's been done in other states, how they've turned it around to get the best bang for the dollar.
I mean, the reality is that tuition at the level you've got it, and et cetera, if the individual, you know, if they're paying that bill and getting nothing for it, there's also a punishment there. I'm not gonna speak about the folks sitting behind me, but I know some other states where they in fact encourage students to enroll in courses that they know they're gonna drop out of.
That was inappropriate.
I'm sorry, I didn't know where this question was coming. I'm sorry. No, I'm sure there's no disrespect.
No, it was a legitimate question.
Well, it's a very good question. Yeah, I think what you want is, as you do your policy, you want to find the right set of incentives. And I think incentives are better than sanctions. And you're right, sometimes one person's incentive is another one's sanction. But you want to find things that work on both the demand side and the supply side of what we're doing. Say Barnhart raised a good issue, I think. Behind his is that you've got to have enough resources to provide a legitimate supply, a good supply of the education. You want to have, on the demand side, the right set of incentives for students to be serious and to stay in there. In part, our dilemma is we're the most benevolent country in the world, I believe. and there are assets to that. But when we're encouraging students often to drop courses. They're in pre-med, they're not getting an A in chemistry. Why don't you drop chemistry and take chemistry next year or next semester so you can get an A because you won't get into medical school without an A in chemistry? That's not, that's not necessarily a productive way to be pursuing. Or the student who's really struggling, who you say, we'd like to provide more resources for, but we can't, so let's have them drop out, and maybe if they take the course next time, they'll do better. There are ways in which if we have the right blend between supply and demand, we expect students to complete courses, that we can create an environment where they can do that successfully and where they'll want to. I think the presumption that students enroll and that with the idea of dropping out is just not a very sound, a very productive one. There's a federal person who says those are casual uncommitted students. There's no evidence that the students who come don't want to succeed in their courses.
President Bohert, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would talk about this in a slightly different way, and I like your term incentive. I'm very aware that as institutions organize themselves, they are responsive to the way in which they get paid, just as individuals are. And some of the points you've made are intriguing to me. I need to understand them a lot better than I do tonight. But if, for example, if we pay for things the way we do it now, there is a huge incentive to bring in more freshmen who are relatively low cost to educate in the very large freshman sections that most of them spend a lot of their time in. But if we don't have some encouragement to actually, from a pay point of view, to actually get them finished, then the more expensive courses, like the upper division lab courses and those kind of things, are more expensive, they are more difficult to do, and the incentive to keep those students isn't there. Now, I'm not saying that any educator purposely sets up things that way.
That's right.
But if you build incentives, I mean, I like the idea that you're describing, as you're describing this, you build incentives for the institution to not let in more freshmen than it can finish with in as seniors, and recognize that those low-cost freshmen are going to become much higher-cost juniors and seniors, and they've got to account for that in the way they do it, because they're not getting paid until the kid crosses the stage with his mortarboard on.
We have conversations like this. You know, one of the realities is universities and colleges are full of very, very bright people.
Yes, that's my point.
And they are maximizing the benefit within the ground rules established for them.
Correct.
Okay. And so if you don't like the behavior, then it's probably a function of the ground rules that have been established for them. And that one is the policy framework within which they live. So you know, that's back to the point about policy matters. When I get into a state, which I do a good bit, and we have conversations about finance structures, first thing I do is say, let's take a look at the current finance mechanism and say, if I'm George or I'm a college president, and say, how do I maximize within this? What behaviors do I engage in? And then ask the question, are those the ones that you think you want? And almost never isn't. Okay, I mean, you almost always the finance mechanism creates inherent incentives for behavior you really don't want. And it's happened for not because of perverse intent at all, but the consequence of a lot of policies lauded on top of each other over a lot of years has ended up with that framework. And every once in a while, you just got to pull the boat out of the water, scrape the barnacles off, and say, you know, can we get this thing sailing again? And you know, that is probably where most states are in their financing mechanisms for higher education.
What is the agreement?
Yeah, I think incentives are important, and the sort of notion of pay for performance is important, but It's also easy to undervalue the importance of 1 year of college, 2 years of college, 3 years of college. I mean, when I look at some tables, I see some college is somewhere between high school graduate only and university graduate on a variety of dimensions, including lifetime income. To a certain extent, we need to understand that university education, I don't need to tell you this, is more than simply a training program to turn out people to work in jobs. I mean, it's involved in citizenship, it's involved in socialization, it's involved in intergenerational mobility. There are a lot of factors, and it seems to me we need to understand the rich mix of college educating kids includes a lot of things besides simply throwing them off the stage so they go get a job as a waiter with a bachelor's degree. And I wonder how we factor that in. And I also wonder how, if we paid people for graduating, it's similar to what the NCAA is beginning to do now to take away scholarships if not enough of the basketball players actually eventually graduate. Wouldn't we create for those smart people some incentives to figure out brilliant ways to bring people back for the last year? Big bonus for Oregon students who are willing to come back from Idaho State where they are and finish at Portland State.
Yeah, I think that's right. And what would be wrong with that?
We could give up the first 3 years of university then. And only, I mean, if we really want to maximize this, it'd be simple. I just have a fourth year of college.
I don't think you're going to have
to be very efficient.
I think what we're doing is trying to provide some incentives along the way. But it is interesting in states that have put sort of a premium on something like this, suddenly you find a much richer relationship between the community colleges and the four-year colleges. Because the four-year colleges can get a hit in 2 years rather than four. So I do think you need, what I would say is you need to look at both the intended and the unintended consequences, and those in both of those categories that are pluses and minuses. And there will be both pluses and minuses, and then sort of add it up. But to Dennis's point, when you do it today, the minuses often outweigh the pluses when you look at the incentives that you've created for very good reason. You know, most of our funding formulas were intended to be fair ways of distributing scarce resources between institutions. And they frankly do that reasonably well, but they don't tend to then attend to other public the broader public agenda of the states wanting to have a larger share of its population. Your points on education is for more than just the development of the workforce, I think, are important ones. Those are never going to be lost, I don't think. But the truth is that if you come out without the capacity to earn a good living, if you don't come out with the capacity to get a good job, most students are disappointed, and their parents are even more disappointed.
Well, but my point is, the assumption is that the folks who start a university and fail are ones who were intended to graduate in the first place. If we're getting students who never would have gone to college and get them to go to 1 year or 2 years of college by having incentives for that to happen, we've done something that has real social value in terms of creating citizens.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the state of Washington, you know, because they've got very, very good data systems and et cetera, can take a look and follow students that started, and this was the community colleges in particular, and say, at what point does education pay off? You know, how much education do you have before it makes a difference that shows up in wage records and et cetera? And the bottom line, basically, is you've got to have a full year of college and a certification that an employer recognizes, whether it's Microsoft or one of them. But you've got to have some kind of a credential that says, I learned something that matters in the workplace. If you don't have, at that level, anything less than that, doesn't show up as making a difference in the pocketbook.
Jim, I'm going to give Representative Robin the last question and see if you have any final words for us. Representative Robin?
Well, you know, we have, in higher education, we have two systems. We have our public and we have our private system. Have we done deals to see if the private system actually gets people through better than the public system? Do we know those? I mean, having had, I have, you know, an N of three with three children. Actually, it's grown to some are married, so I've got an N of four. But of those that have gone, they've actually spent half their time in public and half the time in private institutions. And there is a different way that students are treated in the both, and that's been clear to me. But is there information that would indicate that one does a better completion rate than the other? And is there something that we could look at there that would be helpful for us in this, depending on the answer to that question?
There is a way to do that, and I can't give you the answer. I have my own, I believe I know the answer, but I don't want to, but I don't know that I know the answer, and so I don't want to give it to you. But there is, you can go, the Education Trust, which is an organization out of Washington, can give you statistics on the completion rates for every college in the nation, and so you can look at that. One of the reasons that the graduation rates often look higher at private colleges is that they tend to follow that model that is more akin to the European model than the American model, whereas students who begin there are more likely to finish. Fewer students who transfer from community colleges transfer to private colleges than to public colleges. More and more they are doing that. What I would say is I think there are some really instructive things for us, though, in looking at private colleges. One of the reasons their students complete is that they need the resources from those students to sustain the institution for them to complete. That's not a nefarious thing for them, behavior on there. It's just a realistic thing. If those students don't complete, given what they're paying, folks won't send their children to those colleges. And by and large, those are colleges that serve young, traditional age college students, so that their parents are an actor. They don't serve as many non-traditional older students by and large. There are certainly institutions that George Fox and others that specialize in that. But I think there are things we can learn by looking at those that would help us in figuring out what the right set of incentives are for our public institutions, which I think are doing what they believe you want them to do today. They were enrolling students because our focus has been on access and not on success. And if we focus on success for those access students, I believe they will focus on that because that's what they will see. They will find ways to respond.
Chairman, thank you so much. You've given us a lot to think about. Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to present here as we wrap it up? Or do you feel like you've covered your material?
Make it come out right. What can I say?
One thing I would say to you, and I think this is a real challenge for Oregon. In many ways, Oregon is sort of average. And it's tough to get a sense of crisis when you're average. When I look around the country, the states that are really making progress, if you were to look on that chart of the states, they're the southern states.
Mm-hmm.
Why are the southern states making progress? It's because they believe they're behind. We don't believe we're behind in the West. We are 11 of the 15 states that have a young adult population that's less well-educated than the older adult population. 11 of the 15 are Western, are witchy states. And yet you talk to people, we love the West. We think our places are just the cat's meow. And they are. But that's what I think makes it very difficult for people in your positions as policymakers to sort of get the polity to understand the critical nature of the challenges that we're facing as we move forward.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your time, for coming here tonight to meet with us. Chair Witt, thank you for coming to this hearing. The university system is coming in on Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and we'll talk about some of the same issues, and all would be welcome, and the Education Committee will be hearing their response to all these different ideas. So again, thank you all for attending tonight, and with that, we are adjourned.
Tomorrow?
No, we've got the kids tomorrow.
Okay. Oh, we do.